Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ghosts of the Iraq War haunting the Republicans in the 2016 presidential race, following Jeb Bush's stumbles, and now the impending entry of Senator Lindsey Graham into the race with his call to send an additional 10,000 American troops into the latest Iraq quagmire. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, joins us to provide a perspective on what happened to the monopoly that Republicans had over competence and leadership in foreign policy from Eisenhower through to George Bush Sr., compared to the current crop of neophytes and ignoramuses recklessly trying to prove who is the most hawkish. Then we'll speak with John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent and associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. We will look into the man who might end up as the Republican frontrunner for president and the Supreme Court's rejection of the Governor Scott Walker campaign finance case that is now in the hands of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, a body that Scott Walker has stacked with conservative judges elected on a torrent of campaign money from similar sources that prompted the original criminal investigation into the Walker campaign's illegal coordination with the Wisconsin Club for Growth and other big Republican donors. Then finally, we will speak with independent investigative journalist and historian Gareth Porter, who specializes in U.S. national security policy. He has an article at Truthout, The Misfire in Hirsch's Big Bin Laden Story, and we will discuss what parts of Seymour Hirsch's explosive challenge to the official narrative of the bin Laden raid stand up, and what aspects of his controversial account of the SEALs killing of bin Laden misfire. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And the ghosts of Iraq are coming back to haunt the Republicans, at least their presidential candidates. Jeb Bush had a hard time figuring out whether he supported his brother's war or not, and so did Marco Rubio. And Chris Christie's come out with an incredibly hawkish foreign policy, not that he has much of a chance. And now, of course, Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, who tag teams with John McCain, he'll be entering the race soon. So whatever happened to the foreign policy tradition of the Republicans, who had pretty much had a lock on it, going back from Eisenhower and Nixon all the way through to Bush Sr.?
Well, I think it's been a very long time since we had anything like this in Republican politics, perhaps at no time in the history of the party, because whatever one thought of Eisenhower and the Eisenhower-Taft contest in 1952, or Nixon in 1960, and then again in 68, or even Barry Goldwater, for that matter, there was always a certain coherence to Republican foreign policy in a presidential campaign. I don't think we've seen this much shared ignorance, this much sheer lack of perspective and experience, for that matter, in foreign policy. And the Iraq issue, of course, which is so embarrassing to the party, to the point that some of the conservative commentariat have pointed out that it's ridiculous to even be debating this, that of course it was a blunder, if not a crime. And but that's only one of the issues that they ought to be looking at in terms of national security and foreign policy. And of course, there's none of that. It's a grotesque oversimplification of the issues, and I see no way out of that. I think you're going to have an incredibly empty campaign in 2016, regardless of who the final runners are, regardless of who the nominee is, and I would guess that Hillary Clinton will very much have the field to herself. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be a debate, because certainly Bernie Sanders and The Democratic primary process will raise many of these issues, and Hillary Clinton will be running as usual to some extent against herself in a general election. But this is I think one more sign, Ian, of the utter bankruptcy of this party. The decadence on the foreign policy side, of course, is only a vivid reflection of the same thing that's happened in domestic politics. There is no alternative to whatever one sees on the Democratic side, whether it's neoliberal or more traditional liberal in its approach.
So, do you think that the Republicans have a chance of pushing this narrative that Rubio and Jeb Bush are trying to push, and that is that somehow the Iraq War was an innocent and honest mistake, and it was a noble venture that turned out to be wrong based on faulty intelligence, as opposed to a war that the Bush-Cheney administration wanted?
You know, I think this is a dead end for them, quite frankly. I don't think the popular awareness of the Iraq War now is going to settle on that. I think there are too many Americans who understand that it was not simply a mistake, not simply based on bad intelligence, but that it was a blunder of the first order, which traced to a worldview of America's position and power and all the rest. And I think, ironically enough, the rise of ISIS, the aftermath throughout the Middle East, in Syria and elsewhere, has dramatized that. I think more Americans are more aware, and apropos of all of that, the question that the young woman, the college student, raised with Jeb Bush, didn't your brother, in effect, create ISIS? I think that kind of understanding of what happened in the Iraq War, now it hasn't extended yet to the kind of depth that it should. Obviously, General Petraeus and the whole strategy there of the surge and all the rest, the buying out of the Anwar province and the Sunnis, all of that, of course, is part of the story. So we can't expect too much, but I really think that there's a more sophisticated understanding abroad in America of the fundamental blunder of the war, much more so, I think, even than at this point in the Vietnam experience. I think Americans thought that Vietnam was an unwinnable war. They were not certain why we were fighting it. There was a lot of doubt about purpose and goal. But this is, I think, a somewhat more sophisticated understanding that we had no business mucking around in these politics, and even for that matter, a better understanding of what the aftermath was in terms of installing a Shia government in Baghdad, which many conservatives now, of course, see as an incredible blunder vis-a-vis Iran in the Middle East. So that I don't think this is ever going to be seen really by historians, or even for that matter by the Republican Party, as simply a miscalculation.
But you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Of course, she did vote in that 2002 Senate vote authorizing the Iraq War, and to some extent that cost her support in the primary against Obama, who was lucky enough not to be in the Senate when that vote came down. But she didn't mention it when she was running against Obama, or at least she didn't repudiate the vote. But she did in her new book that came out last year, Hard Choices. She said that the Iraq vote that she took was, I got it wrong, plain and simple. So I guess she's got some political cover there. Well, she's at least...
I think she does, but the whole issue of an elected official believing, crediting bad intelligence, not having the perspective or the insight about American government, I mean, let alone understanding Iraqi politics and society and culture and history, that's a big jump for most Americans, even some of the well-informed. But understanding how the United States government works, the natural and necessary skepticism and even for that matter cynicism at times about the vested interests of intelligence, the intelligence establishment, and what it produces, the conclusions, the black holes that exist always in intelligence. I must say, in talking about this this Republican history, that this is such a dead end to Richard Nixon, for all his other faults, was extraordinarily critical, and I thought often, in my experience there, perceptive about the failures, about the omissions, as well as the biases of the intelligence community. Both the CIA and the Pentagon, the DIA in those days, the natural tendency of bureaucracies to pursue their own interests, to cover their mistakes, to elide over the vagueness and the ambiguity in their findings. Understanding how the American government operates, and it doesn't matter what party you're under at the time, how the bureaucracy operates, is a large part of this problem. And Hillary Clinton, she's going to take that weakness, I'm afraid, into the Oval Office, just as she had it in the United States Senate, and I think to some extent certainly had it in the State Department. And we're seeing some of the backfire of that, of course, in the controversy with Cy Hirsch and this the expose, this 10,000 word piece in the London Review of Books, which tells the story of how the White House, the administration, really, in very egregious ways, falsified the story of the killing of Osama bin Laden. Now, that was an enterprise in which, as you may remember, the famous picture, she's sitting there in the Situation Room watching the live feed with her hand over her mouth, in concern. She's aghast at what's going on the screen. Hillary Clinton was very much a witness to all of that.
Well, in terms of this sort of death rattle of empire that seems to be the theme of these Republican candidates, particularly Lindsey Graham, who I mentioned tag teams with John McCain, the idea that Lindsey Graham has called for sending 10,000 U.S. troops into Iraq, and he also, in a speech the other day before Iowa Republicans, said, "If I'm president of the United States and you're thinking about joining Al-Qaeda or ISIL, anybody thinking about that, I'm not going to call a judge. I'm going to call a drone, and we're going to kill you." Mm-hmm. I mean, these, you know, how much more testosterone-driven, you know, hawkish insanity are we going to get in this race? I mean,
that's what I meant about the decadence here in foreign policy. Really does match the Tea Party fear and ignorance and the decadence on the domestic side. You have in foreign affairs the equivalent of the death panels for Obamacare and the president's birth certificate and all of the other terrible nonsense that attended that revolt from 2010 on, and I think that, of course, inevitably has its impact abroad. I think the rest of the world, looking at this, has to make a judgment about how reliable the American political process is. Now, obviously, a Hillary Clinton presidency will be for many a kind of reassuring continuity, as it were, with not just with Obama, but with her husband as well, and I think that will help mitigate that. But there's no question that it always reminds me of the famous dispatch that the French ambassador sent from Petrograd in 1917 to his government in Paris, the Allied French with the Russian, the Tsarist Russia fighting, and he said, I am constrained to tell Your Excellency that this empire is run by madmen, I think that there's a very strong element abroad that looks at all of this and thinks that at least one portion, the majority now in Congress, it may not last, but one portion of the American body politic is mad.
Well, given some of the candidates, particularly with someone like a Ted Cruz, who's apparently a very intelligent man who deliberately uses sort of provocative and incendiary kind of language, which makes you wonder how deeply cynical he is. He, of course, is going to push the debate into that kind of realm of madness. But Rand Paul is going to push it in a different way, even though he's sort of backed away from a lot of what he said about the American empire. Do you think at least some of that will happen? I mean, this debate that they're going to have is going to be so crowded.
Well, I think to the extent that pandering is the modus operandi here, pandering explains all of the politics of this nomination process. I think Rand Paul withdrew what little sanity and retraction he had and he stood for, certainly his father stood for, again in an appeal for this base. This is appealing to the least informed part of the American electorate, to the most fearful and insecure, the ignorant base really of the Republican Party. And what distinguishes this, what worries me, Ian, is that we have this in every presidential cycle. There is there's trimming and there's this pandering, which is inevitable. But this is a party now which has begun to believe its own pandering, which has begun to believe, I think, and stands firmly on some of the madness in which they run. This is not simply expedient. When Ronald Reagan ran in 1980, you go back and look at that campaign, there were at the time radical statements about dealing with the Soviet Union and all the rest, but nothing like the over-the-top stuff that you just described from Lindsey Graham and that others have already voiced on the campaign trail. And of course, Reagan, we know, despite being a very hardliner in a number of ways for a long time, ended up going to the table with Gorbachev and negotiating and beginning to negotiate, almost reaching some historic agreements with the old Soviet Union. I don't see that capacity. I don't see that fundamental flexibility in this party or in these candidates. And it isn't just a lack of experience. I think they are, in many ways, more ideological in their primitivism than Republicans have been for a very, very long time. You're not seeing. I mean, one looks in vain here. I guess Peter King is thinking about running, and Jeb Bush is touted as the moderate. My goodness sakes, there is no representative, any viable representative in this field of the old Republican establishment, which used to be, after all, the backbone of the foreign policy consensus in the United States. It was the Republicans out of World War II. You remember Arthur Vandenberg and the others who created this whole notion of a bipartisan foreign policy. And even at its worst, at its most hawkish, with John Foster Dulles and the Eisenhower era interventions and covert action and all the rest, it always attracted some support on the Democratic side of the aisle, and it had, after all, a certain intellectual respectability. This is not just ignorance of the world; it's an outright aggressive denial of so much that's going on. I mean, we talk about climate change deniers. There's a denial going on in terms of the process in the Middle East. There's a denial going on in terms of Iran and the nuclear issue there. Certainly a continuing denial with Israel and Palestine. It reaches almost every corner of foreign policy.
Well, just in closing, Roger Morris, in terms of the fateful vote authorizing the Iraq war, that the Democrats bought into that war, I remember at the time of that vote talking with Senator Graham, Senator Bob Graham, who's chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he knew better. In fact, the NIE that they based their judgments on, the National Intelligence Estimate, the Bush administration was so arrogant they didn't even want to have an NIE. They just wanted to go to war. And Graham had forced them to come up with an NIE from which the State Department dissented because it was so bogus. And everybody on the Intelligence Committee knew that it was bogus, yet Feinstein and Edwards, who was, ran for vice president, they voted for it. The rest of them didn't. But the full Senate, it's inexcusable that they didn't listen to Bob Graham. And that includes Hillary Clinton and, of course, John Kerry, who I spent a lot of time with at the very time of that vote, just before it. and people were urging him not to take the vote. And he said, "Well, if I vote against the Iraq War, I'll never get a vote in the South." And guess what?
This is always a mix of intellectual failure, a failure of political courage. Certainly, it was that on many fronts. The thing about that, of course, Ian, is that one can get back perspective that one has lost. One can become more skeptical when one has been naive and too credulous about the intelligence community. You can even gain back some political courage that you've lost. This Republican field that we've been talking about, though, I think it's not a matter so much, they're pandering, yes, to be sure, but not so much a matter of having courage that they've lost and that they can somehow discover down the road. We're talking about a more fundamental way of looking at the world, this institutionalized belligerence, which has become, and arrogance, which has become part of the orthodoxy of that wing of the party. They really are not fit to govern in the 21st century, and they are so far offering themselves, and the country is allowing that, as the only alternative to the Democrats, who, God knows, as you and I have talked often, have their own problems in terms of perceiving the world and dealing with it effectively. But this always reminds me of the old line from Chicago politics, is we don't want nobody, nobody sent. And in this case, the Republicans may end up coming with someone that nobody sent but this ignorant and alienated rump that they have chosen to serve and chosen to empower, really endow, as the authority of their party. And until they make a comeback, until they really enjoy some kind of internal renaissance and reform, I think we're facing this for a prolonged future.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the man who might end up as the Republican frontrunner for president.
دموع من عيني يا ناس ما لي حدا يا ناس ما لي حدا بهمي يواسيني.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way. You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and is the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracy. And their latest book together is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's a great pleasure to be on with you.
And John, on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a petition from conservative groups who want to throw out the multi-year probe into Scott Walker's 2002 recall campaign. Now it's in the hands of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which Scott Walker has managed to stack, hasn't he not? He's changed the rules, gotten rid of the seniority for the senior judge, which means that the progressive judge has been booted off. She's fighting that, Shirley Abramson. And then the new Chief Justice has basically said that even if they got campaign money from Scott Walker's people, that doesn't mean they have to recuse themselves. So this is all starting to stink like bad Wisconsin cheese.
Well, we don't have any bad Wisconsin cheese. I just want you to know. but it is a real patent place. It's a kind of a classic political nightmare scenario. And this is an important one for people to understand. I don't ask Californians necessarily to worry all the time about Wisconsin, but they should be conscious of the fact that Scott Walker is running for president of the United States. And he is running as the embodiment of a new model of politics that seeks not merely to win elections and to implement policies, but to use the power that is accumulated in a off-year election or whatever election cycle you're in to take such overwhelming control that you do, in fact, rewrite the rules, push aside political opponents, political challengers, and particularly mess with the judiciary and with investigative processes. There's simply no question that there are issues regarding how Scott Walker has raised money and spent money, how Scott Walker has, at least allegedly, rewarded political friends and political donors since he has been in power. Those questions should be investigated. That's beyond question. And yet, there has been a constant effort to shut down investigations, to undermine investigations, and now, using a restructured state Supreme Court, where they actually amended the state constitution in order to remove the Chief Justice from her position, you end up in a situation where you run the risk of legitimate inquiries being shut down merely because one political player has accumulated so much power and influence that he's able to do it. That's not the way it's supposed to work in the United States.
But this so-called John Doe investigation that has been secret until last week when the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and other journalistic groups won a court battle to get access to these troves of documents, they go back and fill in a lot of the information about the conviction of several of Walker's staffers for crimes committed while they were working for him. And these they got convicted on charges of corruption and embezzlement. So it's not as if there's not smoking guns here. I mean, when is a fuller picture going to be available here? Obviously, the game is rigged, and the description you just gave of Walker, curiously enough, reminds me of Vladimir Putin, you know. So just let's just stay with the first part of the thing. Is the new information going to make a difference?
Well, here, let's clarify a couple of things. First off, the John Doe is a secret investigation, or supposedly such, and I'm not particularly a big fan of secret investigations for a variety of reasons. But it has been a particularly unsecret investigation. The fact of the matter is people have been aware of the John Doe for quite a while. More information has come out, as you well note. But really, over the last several years, there has been an ongoing dialogue about the John Doe. And there have been revelations and releases of immense amounts of information. There have been, in fact, the chargings and convictions of Walker allies, and those have been public. Those have been known to the people of Wisconsin, less covered by national media. And so it's I would be careful about the Vladimir Putin comparison. I don't think that's what we're really talking about here. What I really think we're talking about is a new model of American politics, which is very manipulative of the legal processes in the courts. And I think that we often see this played out by folks like Scott Walker, but we should be conscious that there are Democrats who play similar games. And what we need to do is to pause and ask ourselves, if you cannot investigate campaign finance issues, if you can't look at questions about whether politicians raise money through means that allow them to hide the sources of money that they get, hide the sources of support that they get, and then potentially reward those who provide them with those resources. If we cannot do that in the United States, if that cannot, those prophecies cannot be pursued, then we have moved to a place where our politics is fully dysfunctional. It doesn't, you know, we will have the facade, we'll have elections and we'll have campaigns, but we won't see who's pulling the strings. We won't see, you know, what's actually happening. And so I hope that there will be continued inquiries, and I hope that these inquiries will go to the core question, not of, you know, what some individual group or person is doing. And I think people do have a lot of rights, freedom of speech rights and freedom of association rights, but to look specifically at what a politician is doing, what a person with immense power is doing, first, to maintain that power and to reward those who help him maintain that power, but also, secondly, to look at basically a corrupt system, a system that is so such a mess and made a mess not merely by politicians themselves, but frankly by our courts, by our U.S. Supreme Court and what it has done to dismantle campaign finance law and to undermine it, but also by the massive inflows of money from very, very influential and powerful people. We're getting, you know, we kind of go down a rabbit hole here, and it can get very complicated. It can get a little bit overwhelming. But the core concept, the one that we ought not lose sight of, is that Scott Walker is a national political figure today, not because he is super competent, not because he is super appealing. He's a career politician who's been banging around at this for the better part of a quarter century. He is where he's at today because he is a master manipulator of money. He's able to get money, to run campaigns where he overwhelms his political opponents, literally floods the airwaves, floods the process, and we the people ought to be able to know how he does that, and if he does it illegally, we ought to be able to hold him to account.
And again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and the author, with Robert McChesney, of It's the Media, Stupid, Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. And their latest book together is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And obviously, comparisons with between Scott Walker and Vladimir Putin are hyperbole. Walker's not invading neighboring states, nor is he running a mafia state. But
Michigan does feel threatened.
But the idea, though, that you capture the judiciary to further your political ends is what I was referring to.
These are concerns that people have. They worry about this because, I think one of the realities is we don't have to make comparisons to other countries. Not that I think they're inappropriate always. I mean, sometimes comparisons are very useful. But in this case, we can look at our own history in the United States. We have had circumstances in particular states, in particular cities, where political machines and powerful individuals have been able to manipulate the process and to make it into something that simply does not function for the whole of the people. You know, it's no mystery that the Chicago political machine of, Mayor Daley, the older Mayor Daley, had overwhelming control of the city, and that other political machines in other communities across the country similarly were overwhelmingly powerful. We sometimes think of that, and when we think of going back even to the Gilded Age politics of the beginning, late 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, we think of that and we see, that's the past. That can't happen again. You could never have a situation, a new Gilded Age, a new machine age, where a particular politician aligned with incredibly rich people could manipulate the process and dominate the process to such an extent that it works solely for that politician and for his campaign donors and not for the rest of us. And yet, what we should recognize is that ours is a vulnerable system. It is a system that is built on and based on a great deal of trust and a great deal of respect for the rule of law. When that trust and when that rule of law is undermined and assaulted, we get into some very dangerous turf. And we've been there before. When we do go there again, we ought to, you know, set off the alarm bells and be very conscious that something inappropriate and potentially dangerous to democracy itself, in fact, I would say absolutely dangerous to democracy itself, is occurring.
Well, the Supreme Court rejected this petition from the Wisconsin Club for Growth, and they're at the heart of what might be sees as some evidence so far that the Walker campaign illegally coordinated with the Club for Growth and other Republican organizations. And what I find extraordinary is that it's the same group that actually funded, and I believe the Koch brothers are among them, that funded the candidates that he stacked the Supreme Court with.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is a case of the best defense is an offense, right?
I really agree that this is the heart of this matter. We have a situation in Wisconsin, and frankly, in a lot of other states, West Virginia, to some extent, people are concerned about what's happening in Pennsylvania, where you've got an elected judiciary, historically elected along, you know, very careful, very constrained lines so that you didn't have huge amounts of money coming in, you didn't have hyper-politicization. We see this changing. We see our judicial elections being radically altered. The Brennan Center in New York has done terrific work. The group Justice at Stake has done terrific work on charting the massive inflows of corporate and special interest money into judicial elections. And the fact of the matter is, if you have special interests, powerful interests, with billions of dollars, and they have the ability to steer a portion of their fortune into the process in order to buy the courts, then that allows them to insulate their political allies, their minions, if you will. And I think you're seeing in Wisconsin some real issues in that regard. And it's significant because Scott Walker is going up politically. He is running nationally, preparing for a presidential campaign. And I would suggest to you that just as we have huge problems with judicial elections at the state level, we also have huge problems with the manipulation of the federal judiciary in order to achieve political ends. Our U.S. Supreme Court at this point is tremendously biased and also tremendously activist on behalf of corporate power. And anybody who doesn't recognize that should go back and read the backstory on the Citizens United case, which opened the door for huge amounts of corporate money to come into our politics. Citizens United wasn't even asking for what they got. What they got was a striking down of 100 years of campaign finance laws by the Supreme Court. And the reason that that happened was because Chief Justice John Roberts was absolutely determined to achieve a political end. And that political end was a massive shifting of the regulations and rules as regards corporate power. And that's, you know, so when someone's running for president of the United States and they've got a track record in their home state of aligning with and benefiting from corporate power and billionaire power influencing the courts, one ought to ask themselves, is that really what you think is going to be a great thing to have in your presidency?
Well, I think John Roberts also, in a sense, is the ultimate, penultimate, if you will, Republican political operative, because the Republicans have a terrible problem with demographics because they're alienating the growing Latino demographic, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's as though Roberts made the calculation that the way to keep the Republicans competitive is to give them unlimited money and at the same time get rid of laws that prevent voter suppression. So excuse my cynicism here, but let's turn to Scott Walker in the presidential race. As you say, this is the reason why it's important to talk about what's happening in Wisconsin, because he is. I mean, he may well be the front runner, given how Jeb Bush is stumbling at this point. But my sense is that he may be a little bit like Jeb Bush. He plays well amongst fat cat donors and in private venues. But on the stump, he seems sort of awkward and stiff. And I mean, if his best argument as a national leader is that I stood up to 100,000 of my own angry citizens as though they were the Goths at the gates of Rome, that's pretty pathetic.
It is pathetic. There's simply no question of it. And it's also tragic. Those 100,000, 150,000 citizens who were protesting at the Capitol, the better part of a million citizens who signed petitions seeking to get him out of office, they weren't best described as angry, although I don't disagree with your term there. They were best described as frightened, concerned. They live in an era of austerity, and they had a governor who appeared, and in fact was, altering the rules and the structures of the state to make it harder to organize and maintain unions, to make it harder to preserve fair wages, to make it harder to, you know, protect workers in the workplace. And they're simply saying, this is bad. This doesn't make sense. We would like to be listened to here. We want to be a part of this process. And instead of responding in any kind of reasonable way to very peaceful, very responsible political engagement, literally the exercise of the right to freedom of speech, right to assemble, the right to petition for the redress of grievances, instead of responding to that with even a modicum of respect, Scott Walker saw it as a personal threat, as something that had to be seen off in the most aggressive of ways. And I think that this is telling. It is gives a good sense of the crisis of Scott Walker. He is someone who is very frightened, very nervous about the popular will, about letting people be heard, about having an honest and open discourse, about potentially bending to the will of the people or even respecting it. And his style is one that is incredibly manipulative, incredibly aggressive in its condemnation of those who might disagree with you. The problem with that is that there's much evidence from his public statements that he seems to conflate pushing off, rejecting, denying the expressions of concern from great masses of people who are, you know, just good citizens stepping up to, you know, raise a sign at a protest, to sign a petition, to testify before a committee. He seems to see rejecting those appeals as somehow preparing him to operate on the global stage against genuine threats, against genuine dangers, against genuine challenges. And anyone who is so deluded as regards what it takes to deal with international threats and global challenges, they would confuse it with, you know, fighting with a labor union peacefully at a local level. That's somebody who's presidential ambitions ought to concern a lot of folks. And I don't know that he is, you know, the comparisons of him and Jeb Bush are interesting because they both have been governors and things of that nature. My sense is that Jeb Bush's missteps are rooted in a lot of family complexity and, frankly, a lot of complexity as regards trying to deal with the reality of his brother and the reality of, his father as former president. And he hasn't looked very good in the last week or so. But that's very, very different from Scott Walker. Scott Walker, when he says things that cause controversy, when he says things that upset and unsettle people, it tends to be, in my view, when he's expressing his deepest sensibilities, his clearest sense of things, which is that those who challenge him are some sort of terrible threat that must be, you know, seen off very aggressively. And when you confuse citizens, American citizens, citizens of your own state, with, you know, global threats and challenges, that's not a healthy sensibility to have in a governor or a president.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure, my friend.
And again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and is the author with Robert McChesney of It's the Media, Stupid: Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. And his latest book with Robert McChesney is Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back speaking with an independent investigative journalist about his article, The Misfire in Hersh's Big Bin Laden Story. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gareth Porter, who's an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy. He writes regularly for Interpress Service and Salon.com, The Nation, The American Prospect, Truthout, and Raw Story. He was the Saigon Bureau Chief for Dispatch News Service International in 1971 and is the author of four books, the latest of which is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he has an article at Truthout, The Misfire in Hersh's Big Bin Laden Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gareth Porter.
Hi, Ian. Glad to be back. Thanks.
And just briefly, what's the misfire in terms of Cy Hersh's big story on the Bin Laden raid, and what did he get right?
Well, the misfire, well, let me start with what he got right, because it makes it easier to organize my thoughts. What he got right was that he exposes in his piece the lies that surround the actual raid that killed Bin Laden. I mean, he shows, I think, quite clearly that a whole series of things that were told the American people by President Obama and by the CIA, for example, that there was not an intention to kill him from the beginning, and that they gave the Bin Laden body an Islamic burial, are just simply fabrications. They're total lies. So I think that part of it I don't challenge at all. I have nothing, no reason to doubt that he got that right. The problem that I see, that what I call a misfire in Hersh's story, has to do with how the CIA found out about the location of Bin Laden at this compound in Abbottabad, city, basically a military enclave, where the Pakistani version of West Point, the National Military Academy, is located, and really has a lot of military personnel. Just a mile or two from the location where Bin Laden had been living for some 5 years. And I think the reason that I believe that this, I'm quite firmly convinced that this is a misfire, it's inaccurate, is that I did a story 3 years ago at Truthout, which was a rather long piece that was based on months of independent research by a retired Pakistani Brigadier General, Shaukat Qadir, who I'd gotten to know on two trips to Pakistan and who I trust because I know he's totally independent, he is dedicated to the truth, and that he has the ability, that he did have the ability to get the information that he talks about because of his long 30-year military career. which involves service in South Waziristan, where the al-Qaeda leadership, Shura, had been operating at the time that they made the decision to essentially move bin Laden from South Waziristan to Abbottabad. And so I tell the story in that article based on detailed interviews and written material that I got from Shaukat Qadir of how bin Laden relocated to Abbottabad voluntarily, believing that he would be more secure, more safe, because he was unable to walk, he was unable to move without being carried around, and that posed security risk for him and for the al-Qaeda leadership itself. And there are other reasons that I detail in the article, but to make a long story short, the whole idea that Cy Hirsch accepted from a former CIA, senior CIA official, that the ISI had captured bin Laden in an operation sometime around 2006 and moved him to Abbottabad and kept him under house arrest simply does not add up. There are all kinds of reasons why this could not be true. And so that's the misfire that I talk about.
But surely, and what I find a little bit incredible about Cy Hirsch's story is that he claims that once the walk-in provided him with the information that he was in Abbottabad, the U.S. then confronted the General Kayani and the ISI leader, General Pasher, and said, we caught you red-handed, and that's why they cooperated, and, yes. And that they were also bribed with money and military equipment or whatever. If in the real world, I would have thought that if this had happened, the first thing that the leadership would do in Pakistan, the ISI and the military, is they'd kill the guy. Or they'd remove him. Say, you know, he's gone. It's not true. There's nobody there. You know.
Well, I think that's one possibility for sure. That does conflict with the official story that is told by this source for. Former CIA source that Cy Hirsch relies upon. There are other reasons why this account that he gives seems to me to contradict or contradicted by the known facts of what happened. I mean, for one thing, the claim is, as you say, there was a walk-in, a former intelligence person that walked in and said, you know, we know where, you know, Pakistani intelligence knows that bin Laden is at Abbottabad and supposedly told the whole story about how he was captured. But if that were the case, if they did in fact have anything like a plausible story that they were able to, detail the account, they would have told President Obama. I guarantee you that. I mean, I know from other cases which involve CIA acquiring information that had to do with a high-profile political issue. Another case I know of had to do with the Iran nuclear issue. And I know that, I've written about this in my book, in fact, that when the CIA received information from a spy who they'd recruited that indicated that the spy knew what Iran's nuclear intentions were, the head of operations of the CIA informed the CIA covert operative that they would personally brief the President of the United States. And that was part of a legal brief. So this is pretty good information that we have on this. So there's every reason to believe that if that story had been true that Cy Hirsch tells, the president would have been informed immediately. Instead, they make it clear that the president was not informed for at least 2 months. And so there's something wrong with that story from that point of view. And there are other reasons why I point out in my story there's strong reason for doubt that this could have been.
Well, it just seems so logical that the Pakistanis, who were deeply embarrassed by what happened, would have gotten rid of the evidence rather than cooperated in the way that Cy Hirsch mentions. But the other part of it that I find that hasn't been properly covered, and that is from the so-called treasure trove of material captured at Abbottabad in bin Laden's lair, my understanding is that what it really reveals is that this guy was completely irrelevant. All he was hearing was complaints from Al-Qaeda that they were on the run, the drones were getting them, they're running out of money, and that he was sort of some deluded old man watching pornography, not this huge threat to...
Well, I don't know about the pornography part of it. It's possible, who knows. But I do know that the rest of it, of what you just said, is absolutely correct. And I, in fact, I talked about this in my own article 3 years ago, based on the Shaukat Qadir account, that the Al-Qaeda leadership, in fact, had marginalized the Bin Laden as the still the formal leader, but somebody who was not really in on their decision making. He was allowed to think that he was still in command, but in fact, as the documents that were recovered from Abbottabad indicate, he was in fact not making decisions. He was simply hearing about things and putting out his own opinions. Those documents show without any question that he was not in a position to actually call upon Al-Qaeda to carry out any operations at all.
So, you know, in a way, we still to this day don't know about who planned 9/11, who financed it, who organized it. I mean, it doesn't. And Bin Laden himself never took credit for it. He just said he was the inspiration for the brothers that did it. But to my mind, that's really... I'm not talking about these stupid 9/11 truther conspiracies, but I'm just saying in the broader sense, after all these revelations, we still don't know the key stuff. I know Senator Bob Graham's trying to unearth some stuff about what was going on with these Saudis here in the United States. But
well, I think the worst part of the situation that you're just referring to about what we know and what we don't know about 9/11 is that there clearly are key parts of this that the intelligence community was putting together based on the torture of certain key individuals, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed being, I think, the primary one, which are inherently unreliable. And so, you know, I think that definitely puts a dark cloud over the whole story that has been formulated about 9/11. Nevertheless, I think there are some memoirs that have been written by people who were associated with Bin Laden during the period in Afghanistan, which do indicate that he was, he was bent on carrying out this operation. I mean, we know that was something that he was interested in. So I think that the basic lines of the story probably hold up, despite the some serious problems with some of the details.
Well, Gareth Porter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Gareth Porter, who's an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy. He writes regularly for Interpress Service and Salon.com, The Nation, The American Prospect, Truth Out, and Raw Story, and was the Saigon Bureau Chief for Dispatch News Service International in 1971, and is the author of four books, the latest of which is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And he has an article at Truth Out, The Misfire in Hirsch's Big Bin Laden Story. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.